Blog Talk Radio.
It's been a long road getting from there to here. It's been a long time, but my time is finally here. I can feel a change in the wind right now. Nothing's in my way, and I'm not gonna hold me down no more. No, they're not gonna hold me down, 'cause I've got faith of the heart.
Good evening, everyone. This is Dr. Jess Armine coming to you from the Institute for Methylation and Bioindividualized Medicine here in southeastern Pennsylvania. Welcome, everybody. We are expecting a blizzard. And I'm still in the office. I'll see if I actually get out of here tonight. But then again, I could live in this office. It's pretty cool. By the way, I'm here 7 days a week, so what's the big deal? Anyway, as many of you know, we had our seminar last week, the Core Knowledge course on methylation and bioindividualized medicine, and it was well attended, it was well received, and very soon we will have the video of the course out. There were many, the feedback was universally positive, so I hope that everybody gets an opportunity to look at various portions of the seminar and learn from them. And so that is like the housekeeping stuff for today. Today we have an incredible speaker, and she is an expert. She is a nurse anesthetist and is an expert on anesthesia as it relates to the autistic child and genetics. Okay, and we're very, very happy to have her. Her name is Sim Renken. Sim is a graduate of the University of Southwestern Louisiana and Charity Hospital School of Nurse Anesthesia. As a practicing anesthetist for over 25 years, she has witnessed an alarming increase in chronic and autoimmune diseases. Those observations became less academic and more personal after her son was diagnosed with autism. Her son's journey of recovery led to Sim's realization that mainstream medicine is far more interested in merely treating symptoms than asking the difficult questions of why those symptoms exist. And here at the Institute of Methylation and Bioindividualized Medicine, we sit there and go, duh. Okay, no offense. It's like, that's why we're here, you know? And she recently joined a practice at True Health Medical Center in Naperville, Illinois, and hopes that, hopefully I've got true information here. And I got to tell you something. I've read a lot of the stuff that she's done, and this is one incredibly intelligent and well-experienced individual. So let's welcome Sim. Welcome. How are you tonight?
Hi, I'm fine. One thing on that bio, I thought it was, I don't work at True Health anymore. I'm practicing as a nurse anesthetist, but I still consult a lot with Dr. Usman. She is basically the light of my life, who helped me with my son and has taught me so much. So anyway.
Amazing. Okay. Well, you know something, being a healthcare provider that you engage in, you know, very traditional type care where you're administering anesthesia, and it's always been said that anesthesia is 98% boredom and 2% being scared. You know what? But we need to know what to do with people with genetic polymorphisms, and especially children with autism. What are the dangers? What are, we have to put them under anesthesia at some point, okay, for whether
right.
dental procedures or anything else. And frankly, this is something I've been very interested in learning about. You know, I know a lot about genetics, but not really how it relates to the various anesthetics. So I'm real happy to have you tonight. So I'm going to let you take it and go in whatever direction you'd like. I'm on the chat. If you hear me, if you hear me typing, I have a chat room in front of me. If anybody needs to ask a question, type it in on the chat room. Later on, we'll try and take some calls. And I'm going to let everybody know that Sim is not able to answer specific questions about specific cases. So if you have general questions, that is more appropriate. Remember that on this type of venue, we cannot prescribe, we cannot recommend treatment. So try and keep your questions on a more general basis. Sim, take it away.
Okay. Well, you know, as we all know, you know, our kids are really sick. 43% of our children have at least one or 20 chronic kind of health conditions. We're more toxic, we need more surgeries, and therefore we're going to have more exposures to the anesthetics. You know, anesthesia and drugs are necessary to prevent that sympathetic response for surgery. You can't do it without it. You know, if you have certain genetic SNPs that affect the metabolic system that detoxify those drugs, you've got to find ways to talk to your anesthesiologist about your concerns from anesthesia. So that's what I'm going to try to help you to do today. Hopefully, one day in the future, we'll be able to have an anesthetic plan individualized to our genetics. You know, we'll be able to pop in our 23andMe, and it'll tell us what kind of anesthetic we can have. So,
from your
anyway,
mouth to God's ears.
Yeah. One day. I mean, unfortunately, as far as...
That day's coming.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it is coming. But, you know, the problem with autism and anesthesia, you know, anesthesia for autistic kids is there's not that much out there in the literature. There is a few articles. I wrote an article a couple years ago. Alyssa Davis wrote an article on anesthesia and sedation risk, and you can find this pretty much online. But, you know, how do we educate our anesthesiologists about our concerns? You know, that's the big problem. The thing about the anesthesiologists, they don't understand that our kids have a medical disease, not a mental disease, okay? You know, our kids have all kind of problems. They have GI dysfunction. They have immune system dysregulation. They have inflammation, mitochondrial dysfunction. There's a lot of stuff out there in the literature about that. Heavy metal poisoning, oxidative stress. You know, some of them have seizures, of course, genetic disorders, and, of course, on top of all that, infections and autonomic nervous system dysfunction. You can look at an autistic kid, and a lot of them are pale and their eyes are dilated. They're in this, like, sympathetic mode all the time. And a lot of them have, you know, neurological problems, too. So, you know, one of the things that anesthesiologists don't understand that these children have impaired detox pathways, and they're not going to metabolize the drugs in a normal fashion. One of the big things I find that anesthesiologists don't understand is that they'll meet that, you know, the kids will wake up and they'll meet that criteria for the discharge, but then they'll go home and they'll have some type of regression, or they'll lose some educational skills or behavioral skills, and that's one thing that we need to really get them to understand.
Go ahead.
Yeah. You okay?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. a few years ago, they came out with a study that said early exposure to anesthetics caused developmental delays. Did you remember hearing about that in 2011?
Mm-hmm.
They came.
Yes.
It was on CNN. It's basically anesthesia in kids linked to learning disabilities and ADHD. They came out with that in like 2011, and it was all over the news, and what they based it on was this study out of Mayo University. In 2009, a study by Wilder and Flick, basically it was called Early Exposure to Anesthesia and Learning Disabilities in a Population-Based Cohort, okay? At Mayo, it's a really interesting study because Mayo University has a big database that they started in 1985, and they followed kids from 1984 for 20 years, okay? And
wow.
What they did is they, in this study, they found that kids from the age of 0 to 4 who were exposed to one anesthetic in that period were okay, but exposed to two or more anesthetics in that period had an increased risk of developmental delays or incidence of developmental delays. So, you know, I started in about 1984, okay, and all we had in our toolbox for kids that we used to put kids to sleep with was a gas called halothane, okay? Halothane, I don't know if you remember, it used to have halothane hepatitis. Do you remember that, Jeff?
Yes. Yes,
yeah,
I do.
It was a very, very toxic. You know, nowadays we have gases that are hardly metabolized, and that's why we have this in-and-out anesthesia. But this stuff used to just stay in your body for a couple of days, and it was very toxic to the liver. So we gave lots of halothane, and then we gave nitrous oxide. Now, nitrous oxide basically brought the gas in faster so you could get to sleep faster, and we could give less of this toxic substance. But we know what nitrous does. Nitrous depletes your B12, and it screws up your methylation cycle if you have a deficient B12. So we gave this really toxic substance, right? And then we screwed up their methylation by giving nitrous, okay? So, you know, you can
It was directly screwed
right.
up. I mean, it's like
right.
this major concentration of it. It's not just, it was like, whoa.
Right. So let's fast forward to where we are now. So, what does that tell you? Tell us, it says exposure of a developer brain to toxins causes learning disabilities, right? So what do we have in our society now? We have BPA, we have Roundup, we have antibiotics overuse, we have the fetal exposures that they get from the mom, all the environmental toxins that children are exposed to, the GMOs, the vaccines, and all the toxins in them. So in my opinion, I think these people just did a study of what causes autism. You know, exposure of a developing brain to toxins causes learning disabilities. You know, it's just trying to, you know, realize that there's a tipping point in our kids. Also, there was another study in 2014, and that was out in Lancet. No, I'm sorry. It was in February 2014. It was in Lancet Neurology, and it was titled Neurobehavioral Effects of Developmental Toxicity. And they talked about the summary of this article was disorders of neurodevelopmental affect 10-15% of births. And they agree that toxic chemicals might be triggering a recent increase in all of these neurodevelopmental disabilities among children. And that all of these things, such as lead and mercury and arsenic and PCB and fluoride and pesticides, and all of the others, basically, even the toxic combination could be causing these problems. And they basically proposed a global prevention strategy. But I don't remember hearing about this in the news. I mean, this wasn't in the news at all. I think this was a pretty big study. But we have to do something. We have to do something about the toxins in the environment and how it's affecting our kids.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
this is amazing. You know, the kids are exposed. I think one of the reasons, I'm convinced that the reason for the increasing rate of autism is the collection of toxicity that our neurological systems are exposed to. And I know that we have genetic and I think that the combination or the constellation of those things conspire to create neural injury, and then it just cascades and creates more inflammation and, you know, right down the path, you know?
I mean, I've even looked at some studies put out by mainstream medicine saying that, you know, all these kids are coming into the hospital. Hospital kids receive multiple medications. I mean, kids go into hospitals, they receive all these medications, and we don't really understand all the implications and all the side effects, and you know, maybe we should pull back a little bit. We just don't understand. You know, a lot of the drugs aren't even tested in children. So, you know, one of the things that came out of this study is that they formed the FDA and the International Anesthesia Research Society form this kind of public-private thing. So they're studying this. It's called Smart Cops. And it's going to take, like they say, 15 years and, you know, $20 million to study how anesthesia is affecting the kids. So they are, you know, the anesthesia community is looking at this problem right now.
I think they need to hurry it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, you mentioned that about children regressing after an anesthetic. I wonder if you could, maybe address that a little bit more specifically as to your opinion, maybe give some examples and let our listeners understand the biochemical and genetic basis of why that actually happens.
Right. Well, you know, the thing is that when kids wake up, they seem fine, but then, you know, parents may bring them home and they might have a regression. You know, I've had a lot of parents tell me their kids lost language, they lost eye contact, they fatigued or even slept hours after anesthetic. So, you know, when you have a regression after anesthesia, I mean, there's multitude of factors that can happen. It's genetics play a big part. If you have CYP enzymes or MTHFR, anything that affects, you know, the mitochondria or the methylation cycle, or even liver detoxification, you're not gonna process those drugs in a normal fashion. And it's gonna be the kid's health status before the anesthetic. You have to take into effect, the length of the procedure, if there's any infections. Any kind of environmental exposures before or after the surgeries, and of course their detoxification and glutathione status. I've talked to a lot of parents about, you know, their kids undergoing anesthesia, and I'll tell you a couple stories. There was a young girl, she was about 12, and ever since she was an infant, she'd have to go into the hospital and she'd put things in her ears. You know, our kids put things in their ears.
Right.
So she would go into the hospital and she would sleep for hours. It was only a 2-minute procedure, but she would sleep for hours after the anesthetic. And usually on ear, you know, when we do ear tubes or, short little cases like that, we just put a mask on, they breathe a little bit of gas and we're done. It really doesn't, take very long. But sometimes routinely they do give Tylenol suppositories to the little kids. And she slept all the time, sleeping forever. So I talked to her. I said, well, just ask them if they can just do a little bit of gas and, ask them, don't tell them not to give any Tylenol. That might be causing her to sleep a lot. And so they kind of fought her for a while. You know, the anesthesiologist wasn't too cooperative, but they finally agreed to just do a little bit of oral Versed. And a little bit of gas. Now, this girl was a big girl, but they didn't really listen to the parents. She was very, very docile, very sweet. I mean, she wasn't going to fight anybody. But they did it with the Versed and a little bit of gas, and she'd only slept for about an hour. She didn't sleep that long. Well, finally, next time when they did it, they just did it with gas, and she was awake when she came out. So, you know, I feel that you have to be careful because a lot of people give drugs routinely, and that's the hard part. You know, you have to ask what they're giving to the child, and you have to just ask them to keep it simple. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Next story I want to tell you is about a little boy who had he was probably around 10, and he had an MRI procedure. And, you know, usually, you know, a lot of these kids have mitochondrial dysfunction, and you have to be cautious when you use propofol, which is a sedative. And sometimes when you do MRIs, you just have to keep them still. So they put them on a drip, and that was fine. But the problem was is that he had an MRI, and then a day later he had another MRI. So he got two big doses of propofol. And what happened is that he was fine. He woke up. They went home. But the child was very tired and very weak and very fatigued for about a week or two. And what propofol does is that it affects that mitochondrial, basically affects the Krebs cycle, And the child didn't make enough ATP, so he was very fatigued for a while. Another case that, you have to be careful when you have a child with mitochondrial dysfunction, and they have to, and we'll talk a little bit more about the precautions you can take with all of our kids. But a big dose of propofol may not be appropriate for someone with mitochondrial dysfunction. Another case was an adult that I talked to. She had a minor GYN procedure that only took about 30 minutes, and she got the normal stuff that you would get, but she took hours to wake up also. So she sent me her 23andMe, and she sent me her her anesthesia record, and I looked at both, and she, of course, she had a lot of CYP plus plus and plus minus enzymes, SNPs in her enzymes, and she had the MTHFR. And I looked at her record, and she got, you know, the normal stuff. And it was odd that she didn't wake up, but then at the end of the case, they gave her a gram of IV Tylenol. So it basically, she had the genetic problems of not being able to detoxify, and they gave her drugs, and then they gave her Tylenol, which basically zapped away 85% of her glutathione, and she wasn't able to metabolize these drugs in the normal fashion, and it took her a while to wake up. So she was a little concerned about this because she had to go back and have another procedure. So, you know, in my opinion, I think it was the Tylenol that basically gave her problems with metabolizing these drugs. So, you know, a lot of factors come into play when you have a regression with anesthesia. So you have to kind of, look at each one of them.
Okay? What do you think the Tylenol does? I understand that it interferes with coenzyme Q10 or the mitochondrial function, but what actually do you think is happening?
Well, we'll talk about that a little bit more later too. But the basically, a lot of these kids are deficient in sulfation and the PST enzyme. So basically, when you use the Tylenol, it leads to overproduction of that toxic metabolite, the NAPQI metabolite.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically reduces your ability to detoxify. And there's a whole – I'm going to talk about that a little bit later because there's a really good article that came out about a year or two ago about Tylenol. But, you know, as far as, you know, there's – for people, you know, who are looking for some information on anesthesia and autism, about a year ago, they came out with a really good article. It's called Anesthesia for Children with Special Needs, Including Autism Spectrum Disorder. It was put out by the British Journal of Anesthesia. And it's very easy to find online. Judith Allison Short and Allison Calder were the wrote the paper. The good thing about this paper is that it looked at a lot of the social things that you have to worry about with a kid. It basically talked about the kids having many physical problems, psychological problems, social problems. They even talked about augmentative and assisted communication, okay? And even talked about, a good pre-op diagnosis and limiting, listening to the parents. And they even had, like, autism do's and autism don'ts. Like, the autism do's was, you want to minimize the waiting times. You want to warn before you make physical contact. Speak quietly and gently. Give clear explanations. I mean, really, it's a very good article for you to get down. They even have a picture communication board that you can use. Another very interesting part of this is that they did, in this article, did talk about that ASD is associated with biochemical and metabolic abnormalities. So, you know, they even talked about mitochondrial dysfunction and increased lactate and B vitamin deficiencies, increased oxidative stress in the kids. But, you know, of course they didn't say anything about gut problems, but, you know, of course this is the British Journal of Anesthesia, so they didn't want to say anything about that.
Oh, God forbid.
But, yeah. So they did, and they did in this article say that, you know, you have an unpredictable regression in skills and behavior. And in this article, they did say it's appropriate, therefore, to adopt an anesthetic technique suitable for patients with mitochondrial disease. And those things are you want good hydration, minimal fasting, you want to you give normal saline instead of the lactated ringers, you want to maintain their blood glucose, body temperature, and acid-base balance, and avoidance of oxidative stress. And that's just, you know, incorporated into everybody's anesthetic, really. The only thing I didn't, you know, the good thing, I like what they said in the article. They did say, while sedative premedication may have been necessary to allow induction of anesthesia, there are advantages to keeping the anesthetic plan as simple, straightforward, and flexible as possible. I'm so glad they said that, because that's what you need to do. You've got to keep it simple. You know, we in medicine, we revert to so many protocols where we give these many drugs and those many drugs for this and that problem, and sometimes you've got to less is more, especially with autistic kids. The only thing I didn't agree with, they agreed to use Tylenol, and that's, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Okay. So when an anesthesiologist prepares for an anesthetic for a child with a developmental delay, we have to look at some medical concerns that are going to affect the anesthesia choices. You know, one of the medical concerns are going to be methylation. If the kid has mitochondrial dysfunction, if the kid has seizures, okay, or any health status, you know, the health status before the procedure, if they were sick. I mean, if your kid is going to have an elective procedure and he's been sick, try to, you know, don't have it. You know, common sense should tell you wait till he's a little bit healthier before you undergo, you know, surgery. You know, there's a lot of stuff out in the literature that discusses autism and methylation. And I think, you know, it's just getting our anesthesiologists to understand that. You know, even MTHFR, even in the adult population, is implicated in colon cancer and breast cancer, heart disease. So, you know, the anesthesia community is pretty much aware of the MTHFR. And, you know, one of the big things with MTHFR is that you don't want to use nitrous oxide because it depletes your B12 and it screws up methylation. There was a study in 2003 that came out where a child who had two surgeries in a row had adverse effects, and he had the MTHFR. And what happened is that he had two surgeries in a row in just a few days apart, that's probably about an hour to each one, and he had nitrous oxide with both of them. So, you know, out of that, they had that study, and I think that's what really showed the anesthesia community that they have to look out for MTHFR. The good thing about this, we don't use nitrous that much anymore in the operating room. It's a rarity. You still use it in dental surgery, but we've stopped using it in the operating room. But it is good to mention also, if you have a child who has an MTHFR, to mention that to the anesthesiologist so they don't use it. There's a good article that explains this a little bit more, and it's very easy to get on the internet. It's "When Nitrous Oxide is No Laughing Matter." It's by Baum, B-A-U-M, and this was published in Pediatric Anesthesia in 2007, and it kind of discusses the methylation cycle and why not to use nitrous oxide. What's really funny, years ago, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it was, just to interject, what a lot of our listeners are, believe it or not, more sophisticated in methylation than most healthcare providers that I know.
True.
Could you and I don't want to put you on the spot, but for the moms out there, and I've always said that there's nothing more impressive than a mother who is researching for her sick child.
Right.
Is there a sort of list of SNPs that they should be looking for that would clue them in to say, hey, we better be careful about anesthesia because I see this, 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 and this?
Well, I mean, you're going to, you know, the basic ones, the MTHFR, you know, it's the whole thing is any of those SNPs that affect the folate pathway, any of the SNPs that, you know, affect the mitochondrial pathway, and there's a bunch of them. I mean, I know from even your little presentation that, you know, the problem is you're not going to have the doctors.
That was 2 hours long, and it took me 10 hours.
Yeah,
to do
no. No.
I'm just razzing.
Well, I mean,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing about methylation, you have so many of the enzymes, you know, the superoxide dimutase enzymes. They're the ones that affect anything that affects glutathione, anything that affects methylation. I mean, the whole point is that, you know, you have a child who's sick, whose detox pathways aren't working the right way. So you want to make sure your anesthesiologist knows not to give the drugs that cause even a further depression of those detox pathways. The thing about this article, When Nitrous Oxide is No Laughing Matter with Bomb, it explains everything. It's a good article to basically print and bring to your anesthesiologist, it'll give him an explanation of methylation if he doesn't understand it.
So if I'm reading you right,
okay.
The SNPs like in the CYP areas, okay,
uh-huh.
Your MTHFRs, MTR, MTRRs, specifically the superoxide dismutase, the nitrous oxide synthase, NOS and SODs, certainly any of the polymorphisms in the electron transport chain like the NDUFS, the COX, the UQCRC2, or the ATP pathways, anything that might under any kind of oxidative stress prevent the entry of the electron donors into the mitochondrial pathway. So anything that would help either block detoxification, block transsulfuration, CBS, CBS mainly, and then block the electron transport chain might be something that, you know, the more you have of it, you know, this puts the body, surgery itself puts the body under a major stress. And then toxic chemicals in there that are necessary, certainly, but still have to be detoxified by the liver pathways. And the free radicals have to be conjugated out. And if certain things are going to mess with the B12 or 5-methylfolate or whatever, the hints are going to be at MTHFR and the methylation pathways and those things that detoxify free radicals in.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, there's a point, though, that, you know, you have to give these drugs for the anesthetic. So, you know, and a lot of drugs affect, there's a whole class of drugs that affect methylation. There's a whole class of drugs, a lot of drugs affect mitochondrial function also. But, you know, you can't do anesthesia without them. So we're trying to make sure that, you know, we can do this in the simplest way possible and let the anesthesiologist know that you have problems with methylation, you have problems with detoxification, you have problems, you know, with detoxifying drugs because you have these genetic SNPs. Which really kind of funny, years ago, before I even started all this, when my son was only one, I came home from work one day, and I had numbness in my hands and my face. Didn't know what it was. I got put in an MRI machine. Nobody could figure out what it was. It would go on and off, and the neurologist said sometimes people get numb. That was my diagnosis. So I got on the Internet, and I said, being in anesthesia for so many years, it must be something that I've been exposed to. So I found an article, and you're looking at 15 years ago, I found an article on the Internet said that people who recreationally use nitrous presented to the emergency rooms with numbness all over their bodies. So every Friday, I would do a room full of kids for a dentist. And back in those days, we turned 7 of nitrous and, you know, 7 liters of nitrous and 2 of oxygen, and we put the gas on, and the kids would squirm, and we're breathing it the whole time. So I noticed that when I would do kids, I would get numb. I didn't make the connection that it was B12, and, of course, I have the MTHFR, but I was getting, like, a neuropathy from a chronic exposure of nitrous oxide. So, you know, you have to, later on I found out, well, now I have to take B12, and now, I stay away from nitrous. I stopped doing kids for a while because I didn't understand why I was getting numb. But it was, the nitrous oxide. So, a lot of kids also have, the mitochondrial dysfunction. And, mito's even implicated in Alzheimer's and dementia and a lot of the, diseases such as lupus and MS and ALS. A lot of kids suffer from mito dysfunction. There's a lot of research, a lot of articles out there. An anesthesiologist at Kennedy Krieger, Dr. Richard Kelly, he wrote a lot of papers on mito disease and anesthesia. And basically, it's just taken the mito precautions, the same thing that they said in this British Journal of Anesthesia article about an early case time, no lactated ringers, avoiding large doses of propofol. So if you have a kid who has a mito dysfunction, you need to tell the anesthesiologist that so they won't use those big doses of the propofol. But, as I said before, unfortunately, most drugs affect mitochondrial function. So it's good to let them know that your kid does have a documented case of it. And, of course, what do? We usually use supplements to support the mitochondria. So that's another thing that we can do to help.
Now, how would you know if somebody has – I know there's a difference between mitochondrial disease and mitochondrial dysfunction. But I don't – how would you make that differentiation?
Mitochondrial dysfunction is – I mean, disease is a much more severe case. But Dr. Rossignol and Dr. Fry in the autism community have made a lot of papers out on mitochondrial dysfunction in autism. I mean, it's you've got a lot of hypotonia kids and developmental delays. A disease is where it's severe mito disease where, you can't breathe, where it's more motor, if you kind of understand me in a way. That's the difference.
I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. Mitochondrial disease is a more severe form. A dysfunction, especially in autistic kids, you see more fatigue, you see more a little bit more hypotonia. A lot of our kids don't, ride bikes until much later, or, they're very fatigued. They don't participate in a lot of sports and things like that. So, basically it's your Krebs cycle, If what do you do to feed in that Krebs cycle? You have the breakdown of protein and the breakdown of fats. And if we have kids with GI problems, they're not feeding the nutrients in that Krebs cycle, and they won't make ATP and energy.
No, I agree with you. I didn't know.
Yeah. Sorry, but there's a lot of a lot of kids in the autism community is on some type of mito support. It's a bunch of B vitamins, some CoQ10, riboflavin. There's a mito support a supplement that a lot of the kids are on that they seem to do very well on. And improving their symptoms.
What mito support supplements do you usually see the children on?
I know that my son is on a compounded one. Usually, the biomedical doctors will compound a supplement depending on the child and their needs and based on their biomedical testing. I think a lot of, you know, people who are going to the biomedical doctors with their kids for autism, a lot of them are on some type of mitochondrial support.
Are they? I sincerely hope they are, because that's the main issue.
Right, right.
Okay, there's very few people, I think, out there. Many doctors play lip service to the mitochondrial function, because up until a few years ago, it wasn't that well understood, and it was always thought to be mitochondrial disease, and there was nothing you could do about it.
Right.
Presently, we know that there are numerous ways of getting the mitochondria to function again. You got to get rid of the oxidative stress, or at least get it down to a reasonable level before you start treating it. But, you know, people, I think, need to hear some of the supplements that are generally used, because there are a lot of practitioners, allopathic and alternative, who are treating things, shall we say, partially. Okay,
yeah.
Either due to, I'll give them a break and say, because they don't know. So I know that like coenzyme Q10 would be something that we would usually use, either NADH or NAD or so forth. Do you have any suggestions of other things that help the mitochondrial pathway, just generally speaking?
Well, I know that, you know, there's a lot of websites on mitochondrial dysfunction and a disease, and I know that there's certain protocols that they follow. I mean, even mainstream medicine has a protocol for mito support.
Oh, God forbid, if they didn't have a protocol, they wouldn't know which way to walk.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, of course, yeah.
I'm sorry.
But they,
you know,
they
you
do
know,
have protocols. They do, I mean, you know, a lot of the people that treat some of the mitochondrial disease and dysfunction. I mean, it's becoming more aware. I mean, a lot of people are more aware of it. A lot of doctors are more aware of it. So they are treating it, and there are specific protocols. I think maybe out of Kennedy Krieger, they're doing a lot out of there. They have a lot of that on their website. So that's what I'm saying. A lot of the kids are on some type of mito support, and that's something that you really need to do under a doctor's care. You really shouldn't do that on your own. You should get the proper testing, and then have a doctor help you with that instead of doing that on your own with your child.
What do you think is the proper testing, or what can you share with our audience about the reason I'm jumping on mito right now, because I know you're an expert, and I want to pick your brain about the diagnosis, or at least the evaluation and treatment of mitochondrial dysfunction, because it is such a salient point that is often overlooked. So maybe could you share with us some of the testing that you usually see that people do to say, oh, we have mitochondrial dysfunction, we don't have mitochondrial dysfunction?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of blood tests they use. They usually do carnitine levels. There's a lot of functional medicine testing that they do. Dr. Fry I think he's in Texas now. He's doing some stuff with the folate, measuring, folate in the cerebrospinal fluid. This is something, you know, the mito testing you should get under a doctor's care, and then they can figure out, exactly what you need for a mito support. But there's a lot of stuff on the internet, Dr. Rothignol and Dr. Fry, and I know that Mito Action is a website, I think, that they have a lot of information. It's mitochondrial disease website.
Did you say Mito Action? Because I'm going to
Mito Action. Yeah. So you can kind of get a lot of information on mitochondrial disease on that. Okay.
Hmm. I'm putting it on the chat room.
Okay.
So that people can see some of the things that you mentioned. I like to put out there so people can look at it. You know.
Okay.
But I think the takeaway here is that mitochondrial function slash dysfunction is a major, major issue that is involved in all chronic diseases and is especially of consideration when one wants to consider anesthesia.
Right, right. Well, I mean, the whole point is that, you know, your Krebs cycle, that's the, you know, what feeds into your Krebs cycle is the breakdown of your food, of your fats, of your proteins. And it goes into the Krebs cycle and makes ATP and energy. And what slows down the Krebs cycle is all the toxins too. So, you know, it's a whole body approach, you know, when you just don't want to treat mito, you want to treat the gut, and you want to treat the kid, and you want to treat the environment. So it's a whole body kind of thing to kind of detoxify. And once you detoxify, I think your mitochondrial function is going to get a whole lot better also.
True. Very true. Very true.
But, you know, as we're talking about, you know, mitochondrial function and anesthesia, you know, the problem is that you have to have drugs for the anesthetic. And a lot of these drugs affect mitochondrial function. So if you have some SNPs in your pathway in your 23andMe that's going to affect mitochondrial function, it's best to let the anesthesiologist know so he can use the drugs that will affect the mitochondrial function the least. You know, he won't use that big, gigantic dose of propofol. Okay.
You know, this segues into a really important part of our conversation, and we spoke about this just prior to going on the air. I think we really need to know how to speak to our doctors, how to speak
right.
to the anesthesiologist. What do we need to say or do to get them to listen? Now, I know everybody in the whole world is just sitting up saying, "This is what I'm here for. Please tell me." Because
yeah.
let's face it,
okay.
You know, it's all in the way. It's all in the way you approach it. You know, I tell my patients,
right.
don't ever walk in and say, "This chiropractor said this." I tell them exactly how to approach their doctors. So, if you could enlighten us, it would be very helpful.
Okay. Well, you know, you have to have drugs for an anesthetic. And the thing is that, you know, you can't go in there and say, don't use this drug, don't use this drug, don't use this drug, because they will think of you as crazy mom or crazy parent. So, you know, another way to approach this is that, you know, you have to go in there and say, look, you know, I have a kid who's very sick, or I have a kid who's had some problems with this before, and, you know, he's got some genetic SNPs that, you know, he may react to the drugs a little bit differently. You have to kind of go in that direction instead of saying, don't use this because he has mitochondrial dysfunction, or don't use this because he has this. Because you have to use drugs for the anesthetic. I mean, that's a given. But when you think about it, you have to look at the risk versus the benefit. An example, we know that nitrous oxide depletes your methylation. Okay. Now, they use a lot in dental anesthesia. What you have, and you know that, you know, it depletes methylation and it basically depletes your B12. So if you can support that pathway and give some B12 before and after the surgery, it will help. So what I'm trying to say is that is it better for you to have, let's say you have a tooth pulled, is it better to have 10 minutes of nitrous oxide in a chair, you get that tooth pulled right away, or have to go into the hospital and be put under and use gas, okay? What's going to be better for the child, a few minutes of nitrous or a whole anesthetic with a whole bunch of drugs, okay? Do you understand that?
Sure, the whole bit of a risk-benefit
okay.
factor, sure.
Yeah, it's so you have to kind of
It's like every
that.
Other word in my consultations, yeah.
Right, right. So, I mean, the best thing to do is, you know, call the anesthesia department to discuss your concerns. You know, call them pre-op. Talk to them. Let them know any kind of physical, any kind of communication problems, behavioral problems, social problems, anything that the anesthesiologist should know to make that experience go a little bit smoother. You want to ask for an early surgery time. You know, our kids do better in the morning anyway. It's going to be better to get that early time and get it over with. Make sure that the doctor knows that any kind of history of problems with previous anesthetics or any kind of any drugs, especially if the child had any kind of recent fever or cold or infection. If he has, and if it's a surgery that doesn't need to be done, make sure he's in the best health that he can be in before you have that surgery. One of the things you need to try to talk to him about is you want to just try to talk to him about any kind of medical or metabolic problems that affect your child. You know, talk to him. Say, look, I've got a child with the MTHFR. I've got a child who has mitochondrial dysfunctions. He's on mito support. He has a history of seizures. He has problems with detoxification. His glutathione is low, or he's had surgery before and he's had trouble waking up. You want to try to explain to them in that fact instead of saying, don't give nitrous oxide, don't give propofol. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you go in, right. in that direction and try to get them to understand, and you know, anesthesia is pretty individualized to each patient. So he should make that decision of looking at all the things that you present to him. Make sure that they know if he has any allergy to drugs, or even any kind of foods. Really important to let them know what kind of medications or supplements they're on. One of the things that you should talk with them about is the administration of any other drugs that they might give. One of the things, and we can talk about Tylenol a little bit here now.
Great.
You know, Tylenol is one of the most used drugs in the medical community. It's they had an article that came out. Have you read that article, Jeff? It was by William Shaw.
On
Tylenol?
I read a lot of articles on Tylenol. Which one was this?
Okay. Well, this one came out. This is pretty recent. It came out 2013. It was in the Journal of Restorative Medicine. Very easy to get on the Internet. Just do a Google search on autism, Tylenol, and Shaw. And it will pop mm-hmm. up on the Great Plains website. And, you know, what he found is a really good article about acetaminophen and how he thinks it's implicated in the autism epidemic. One thing that was very interesting, and I didn't know about that, is, you know, Cuba's autism, I think they have 185 cases out of a total population of 11 million people. That's how they have
impressive.
It. Yeah. They have a highly vaccinated population, okay? But there's a difference. They do not use Tylenol for fever over there at all. They use another drug called metamizole. It's used in other countries, but they don't use it in the United States because it has an association with a granulocytosis. So I find that to be pretty interesting that they, you know, they advise parents. They don't give acetaminophen. It is basically a prescription drug over there. And, you know,
like
in the United States, they've already, you know, people, I did this with my son. You know, we gave Tylenol with every single vaccine. So you injected all those toxins in the vaccines, and then you basically took away their ability to get the drug out. So they had the FDA warning probably a few months ago. I don't know if you remember this, but they basically informed the medical community to only use a 325 milligram dose when you put it with another drug. You know, you have Tylenol with codeine and some other
mm-hmm.
drugs. They reduced that thing. And they even came out, they're even implicating Tylenol taken during pregnancy has an increased risk of autism and developmental delays also. And I think the FDA just came out with another thing recently in the last 2 weeks about pregnancy and Tylenol, but they were kind of wishy-washy about it and didn't really say, no, don't use it, but just to call your doctor and we'll use it only if necessary. So in this paper also, And there's study after study that shows that the rate of asthma correlates with the use of acetaminophen. We had a big increase in the in that time frame of asthma, and there are studies that have come out saying that, and it's pretty much accepted that it is implicated with asthma now. So, unfortunately, they routinely give it to a lot of kids. If you have ear tubes or tonsils, they routinely give acetaminophen suppositories to the young ones. I've seen them, you know, we're using IV acetaminophen now for pain relief in the adult population.
Yes.
And, yeah, so that's something you really need to talk to your anesthesiologist about. It's people with metabolic problems, probably, you know, with the MTHFR and the mito problems that we see in our population, shouldn't really use the Tylenol. Maybe you could bring your own dye-free ibuprofen to the hospital with you. So that's something you really need to talk to the doctor about. What else is he going to give your child? And, you know, the most important thing you want to talk about, they pretty much know about the mitochondrial dysfunction considerations. You know, you may want to do some pre-op testing, do some carnitine levels, the hydration. You want to avoid fasting for a long time, so you want to be that first case. Pretty much, it says to avoid lactated ringers. In children, we always pretty much use normal saline anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You have to watch your temperature and blood glucose. And just be careful with a lot of the muscle relaxants and the propofol. So the anesthesia community kind of understands that mito dysfunction considerations. And it was in that article in the British Journal of Anesthesia, too. That's a good one to basically print and bring to your anesthesiologist. I'm sure he's probably seen it. You know, you want to go ahead and discuss the use of nitrous oxide. And if you remember, it's all about the dose. I mean, we rarely use it for long cases anymore. You might want to discuss using it. If you have a child who's going to have, it's a vaginal procedure, you can have it done very simply with a few minutes of nitrous and support. Support before and after with some extra B12. It might be better to do that instead of putting them into the hospital and going for a general anesthetic. The most important thing you can tell your anesthesiologist also is just to keep the anesthetic as simple as possible. You know, just keep it simple. Only give him what he definitely need.
They absolutely need.
And I think,
right.
anesthesia is very individualized, you know, and sometimes we revert to these protocols that give a lot of drugs, but if you make him aware that he has these problems with detoxification and he has some metabolic problems or some, you know, SNPs in the MTHFR, they will pull back and, you know, it's I think they'll understand that kind of approach much better than going in there and telling them, don't use nitrous, don't use this, don't use that, okay?
I think what we're going to do is find those articles and post them on mthfrsupport.com so that people can access them. It sounds to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I always like to sum up what my guests are saying, because I feel like I know my audience fairly well.
Can I just add one more thing? You know, one of the things that, you know, when you go under an anesthetic, you realize that it is a chemical exposure, okay? But it's a necessary chemical exposure. You've got to give an anesthetic if you're going to have surgery. But, you know, you want to look at detoxification and things that you can do before and after, okay, to kind of help clear these chemicals. So, you know, remember detoxification things, and it's best if you have an autistic child to call his biomedical doctor and talk to him about this before you go under an anesthetic. So a lot of kids, you know, the most important thing is hydration and elimination. You want to hydrate your child before and after the procedure. You know, think kidney, so you want to make sure that he can clear those drugs that he is going to get. Epsom salt baths may be good for some kids. Things that kind of bind, we use binders on autism community like charcoal or berber or parsley or clay. you know, you can support the liver with some milk thistle, some antioxidants, you know, magnesium, you know, and then, of course, lymphatic drainage, you know, just the massage and trampoline and dry brushing. So you really want to, you know, talk to your doctor before and after the surgery. Talk to your biomedical doctor to kind of see what best works to help him detoxify these drugs or help your child detoxify these drugs after the anesthetic, you know. Make sure that he's well hydrated and that he's pooping and all those channels of elimination are open.
That's good advice. That's really good advice. So people with detoxification problems, MTHFR, mitochondrial problems, these are the things that need to be brought to the anesthesiologist's attention. And it sounds like the anesthesiologists are probably more oriented and more understanding of the significance of the mitochondrial problems. Sometimes when you throw MTHFR at them, they kind of look at you cross-eyed.
Maybe
not much anymore. I don't know where it is these days. You know.
Yeah, so I mean, I think they're a little bit more aware. But that's when you know. And they know we're not using nitrous oxide in the operating rooms too much anymore.
Okay. So, if you could sum up for us, and I think this would be beneficial. The things that we should look out for, the things that the manner in which we should approach anesthesiologists. And remember, people, you have the right to ask the doctor what's going on. I mean, it is your absolute right to say, well, this is what I'd like you to know. It's the healthcare professional's job to discuss with you things. And you know, there's certain anesthesias that are necessary. I think Sim tells us, and rightfully so, that this is a chemical exposure, and it's a fairly toxic chemical exposure, but a necessary one. And you can mitigate it by doing certain things that she's mentioned. And mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be an injurious thing that lasts for a long time. There are things you can do to help this along. If anybody in the chat room has any questions, I see a lot of people listening. I don't see any typing going on. I would be happy to transmit a message and ask it of Sim right now. Is there any other words of wisdom that you'd like to give us that would help? This is a very important subject matter. So is there anything else that you'd like to give us that people can utilize to keep their children safe?
Well, I think, you know, just call the anesthesia department ahead of time and try to talk to an anesthesiologist before and let him know, you know, what your concerns are. You know, approach it in a way where, you know that, try to ask him to please just keep it as simple as possible. And you do have the right to ask what drugs are going to be given. And, you know, one of the things that I'd be pretty strong about is the Tylenol issue. And there are other things that you can do besides Tylenol, and that's something that mm-hmm. you may have to discuss with them. Believe it or not, there's some anesthesiologists that are kind of backing off from the Tylenol. I find that. They're not giving it as much as they used to. But
I find that amazing because I had had a me IV Tylenol. Now I'm upset.
You had IV Tylenol?
Yes, I did. You know, I said, oh, that sounds interesting, you know.
Yeah, it's they're using IV Tylenol a lot. And I don't know, I don't use it routinely unless the doctor orders it. And I question and I tell him what I think about it. But
I have no doubt that you do.
Yeah, I have no doubt that I do too. But anyway, I mean,
okay.
There's a lot of information.
It's a good
thing. Our kids are, our kids are sick, and you're going to protect
your
baby.
If we don't advocate for them, who will advocate for them?
That's right. And you know, you just got to realize that I think if you approach it in a way, in a concerned mother kind of way or father kind of way, and not try to tell him what to do. I mean, it's all about their ego too, but and I think right. they'll listen, you know. One thing about anesthesia is that it is a very individualized protocol, you know. It depends on a lot of different factors of how long the surgery is going to be and, you know, what kind of surgery it's going to be and the effects of the child, you know, the size of the child. And if you tell them that, you know, you have a kid that doesn't detox well, that's sick, you know, they're going to know, I'm not going to use the normal stuff. I may back off a little bit. But, you know, as if anything, they you know, you have to give anesthetics, and there is a safe way to do it. And believe it or not, the anesthetics now are so much more specific, you know, receptor specific. You know, long time ago, we used to have gases that you would breathe in, and they would stay in your fat, and it would take you a couple of days to clear everything. Now, you know, you have SIBO, where you breathe it in and you breathe it out, and only 2-5% of it is metabolized. So, I mean, that's a good thing. I mean, that's why, you know, anesthetics have improved. That's why we can have all this in-and-out kind of anesthesia, mainly because of the anesthetics that have become more receptor-specific. They don't have all the side effects that they used to have 20, 30 years ago.
There was an interesting question here on the chat, and it says, what advice do you have for dentists who treat a lot of children with autism, excuse me, who may not have had any testing for MTHFR defects? Should they avoid nitrous oxide with all untested children on the spectrum?
Well, you see, that's...
And if you can't answer the question or you don't feel comfortable, just say
No. I mean, that's the dilemma that you have, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, nitrous oxide, the problem, it's the dose of the nitrous oxide. If you give it for a long time, I mean, I had a chronic exposure where I was breathing this gas every Friday for like 6 or 7 hours, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had this chronic exposure where I had this neuropathy, okay? And I have the MTHFR. So, you know, you have to look, you know, you have to look at the benefit versus the risk. And,
right.
You know, the problem in that study that they had out years ago is that this child had, you know, hours and hours of an anesthetic with nitrous in it in two consecutive anesthesias in a short period of time, which severely depleted his B12. So, you know, if you have a lot of dentists, and I've talked to some dentists that do take care of these kids, and you know, when you think of the nitrous oxide, you breathe it in, you breathe it out. When you give an IV drug, I mean, 100% of that drug has to be metabolized and use all those, you know, use all those detox systems to get it out. So, you know, is it better to just use a few minutes of nitrous oxide versus having to do more drugs? You understand what I'm saying? It's a hard question to kind of answer. You really have to... you know, look at the child. You know that, you know, nitrous oxide depletes your B12. And if you, a lot of these autistic kids are on B12 shots or they have some type of methylation support in place already, okay? So you have to kind of take the path of least resistance. If you didn't want to have it done in the doctor's office because that's all they use is nitrous and you go into the hospital, then you're going to have a general anesthetic with all the other drugs. Okay, so that's something you really need to talk with your biomedical doctor before you have the procedure and with the dentist also. And some dentists,
okay, so,
you know, do offer a little bit of sedation instead of the nitrous, but, you know, it's a hard decision to make, but I think that the few minutes that you're under the nitrous oxide, if you if you have some methylation support in place, I think it would be fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like, I mean, if I don't miss my guess, this is quite individualized.
Right, right.
Okay, and there's nothing wrong with that because what can you say?
Right, and that's
okay,
it has to
be individualized.
Saying, yeah. Right.
And
it's
a clinical decision.
Right, right. And you know, you explain to, you know, a lot of kids are sick, and we're putting a lot, a lot of kids asleep that are very ill. So, you know, we're aware of the problems that you can run into. And, you know, we're aware of the mitochondrial dysfunction in these kids, and we're aware of the methylation problems that these kids have. So we have to look at all the drugs that we have and try to keep it as simple as possible and try to take the path of least resistance. So, you know, where we'll have the least amount of problems, you know, post-op.
So what you're saying is the anesthesiologists are in fact aware of these various issues, and we simply need to bring it to their attention and politely ask to keep it as simple as possible. Because let's face it, they have your child's life in their hands, and they have to make decisions of how deep the anesthesia needs to go depending on the procedure, how long the anesthesia has to be there. There's a lot of decisions to be made, and you know, that's why anesthesiologists and nurse anesthetists are some of the best clinicians on the planet, to be perfectly honest.
Well, you know, it's hard, you know, when you have a child undergoing anesthesia and you want to advocate for him, and you have the right to advocate for them, and you have the right to ask the anesthesiologist questions of what are you going to give my child, and but, you know, when you talk to them, try to tell them, you know, please try to keep it simple. You know, a lot of, you know, and they've heard this too. A lot of kids in the autism community have problems with anesthesia. When they're given too many drugs, or when, you know, the anesthesiologist is not aware of the medical problems that the kid has. But a lot of, you know, there's a lot of articles in our community that do discuss, you know, problems with methylation and with mitochondrial disease also, mitochondrial dysfunction and disease. So anesthesia, you know, the anesthesiologist is aware of it. We just have to make sure that they know that our child has this. And that's the big disconnect, because they still think of autism as a mental disease, not a medical disease.
True. But even that's changing now.
Okay,
if they think of it as a mental disease and you bring up the biomedical issues and the epigenetic issues, you're putting them on notice. And if they're oriented to this, then they will make allowances for it. Okay, and that's good. Well, you know, I got to tell you, this has been an eye-opening thing, especially about the Tylenol, by the way. Okay, I didn't realize how much of an issue it was. I mean, yeah, I've read it, and then, of course, I shrug my shoulders and say, well, it's Tylenol. You know, what's a big deal? But I didn't realize the complete how significant it was, and how it really interferes with the Krebs cycle and the ability to make ATP and so forth. I have to tell you that this has been an incredible discussion. Do you have any parting words for our audience that you'd like them to, anything that you'd like them to know to take away with them?
Well, you know, just, you know, be an advocate for your child and just tell the anesthesiologist, please keep it as simple as possible. And, you know, the anesthesia people want to do a good job. They want to, you know, that's our job is to provide an individualized care plan. So I think if you approach it in that manner, you'll get a lot of good cooperation from the anesthesiologist.
Well, I'd like to hear that, because I think people are still, you know, thinking that they don't have the right to speak to or bring things in. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for what information they need so that they can, you know, give the best anesthesia, the safest anesthesia, because, like I said, it can be a scary thing, and you do have somebody's life in your hands, you know.
Right.
And have you been an anesthetist for over 25 years? That's amazing.
About 30 years.
Wow.
A little bit longer.
I must have an old bio here.
Yeah. I think you have an old bio. I said the new bio, but with the changes in it, so sorry. Yeah, no, I've been doing this since 1984. I got out of anesthesia school in 1983. Yeah, I got out of anesthesia school in 1983. So, yeah, it's You know, it's what I find too. A lot of the doctors now, I mean, you know, they're starting to think like we are. You know, they're starting to ask questions and look at a more functional approach. You know, you still have a lot of people that don't, but I think a lot more people are, you know, cleaning up their diets and looking at environmental factors than they did 20 years ago.
That's true. That's true. And just the fact that they're willing to listen and willing to make compensations for the children or the people who are having the epigenetic problems, it's that's a wonderful thing. You know?
Yeah.
Well, I thank you so much for being on the show. This has been an eye-opener for me, I know that. And I know for our audience, they've been wanting, we often get these questions, and honestly, you know, I try my best to answer them, but, you know, you've given me the best answers to give to my clients tonight. You know, I now know what to tell them to do and what not to do based on their particular references. So I appreciate the time that you put in, you know, and the time that you gave us tonight, because I know you're a busy lady.
Well, thank you. And you know, please let me know if I can help out any other way.
Do you have, I meant to ask, do you have a website of your own? Or?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
I was looking today, and I'm like, usually at the end they say, you know, my guests say usually have a website or they do something, and I let them, you know, let everybody know how to get in touch with them. But I didn't find one for you, and I was like, I figured I'd better ask.
Well, I'm a busy mom raising a teenager, and it's just high school.
Well, then we know that you're a busy mom. I know how that can be.
Yeah.
Having three sons of my own. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I would thank everybody for listening in tonight. Like I said, we're having the beginning of a blizzard here, so I'm going to sign off and attempt to get home before it gets any worse. Still in my office. And as much as I like being in my office, I don't think I want to spend the next 48 hours here looking out the window. So I wish everybody a good night. Thank you very much, Sen, for being with us tonight. And
okay, thank you.
Keep an eye on mthfrsupport.com and the rest of the websites that we usually do. We're usually looking at mabim.org, and we're going to have more guests very soon with varied subjects. Again, thanks, everybody, for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Jeff. Bye-bye.